are you here? Are you prisoners too?
Prisoners?
This is one of the places Zorkon sends people when he wants them to disappear. Didn't you come in through the time portal?
Yes, we came through the time portal, but not as prisoners. We were sent here by mistake.
Oh. The Atavacron is far away, but I think you come from someplace farther than that.
That is true. I am not from the world you know at all. My home is a planet millions of light years away.
Oh, how wonderful. I've always loved books about such possibilities.
We are trapped here in this planet's past, just as we are. And we'll stay here for the rest of our lives. Now, do you understand?
Yes, I understand. I never thought I'd hear it. But I understand. You want to stay here. As a matter of fact, you're highly motivated to stay in this forsaken waste.
The prospect appeared quite attractive to you a moment ago.
Now you listen to me, you pointed-eared Vulcan.
I don't like that. I don't think I ever did, and now I'm sure.
What's happening to you, Spock?
Nothing that shouldn't have happened long ago.
You are beautiful. More beautiful than any dream of beauty I've ever known.
Now, Whom Pods Destroy.
Welcome to Whom Pods Destroy, a Star Trek discussion podcast. I am Terry, and I'm joined, as always, by Graham.
Hello.
And by Derek.
Howdy.
Well played, Del Boy. Good response there. How are we doing, chaps? All right?
Yes, it was good.
Seems like ages since we were last here.
It really does, doesn't it?
It seems like it. But it wasn't. It was actually only a couple of minutes ago. We recorded our last episode on Spock, and we're recording a new episode. And this episode is about the Star Trek original series story, All Our Yesterdays, from the third season, one of the last episodes of Star Trek, the original series. Second to last, Graham?
Second to last, yes it was. Yeah, the penultimate episode.
Let me chuck a comparison with you. If I was to say to you, Abbey Road and Let It Be, what would your response be?
Well, yeah, I think there's... Well, personally, I look at this episode and I really wish this was the last one that they'd actually done.
Yeah.
It's a real shame that Turnabout Intruder
was ever conceived, let alone commissioned, yeah. Let alone filmed, let alone broadcasted.
Yeah.
Is it true that sort of like there was a big gap between them in the States that they actually, before they showed the second to last, this episode, and the last episode?
I don't know if that's true, Del. I'm afraid I don't know.
Because then, you know, obviously the series was coming to an end.
We've got the Companion. We could look it up, but I'm not certain how much value there is in that. But I mean, yeah. Well, that's some research for our listeners.
But what we're just trying to say, actually, this second to last episode is the better of the two.
By some margin. I mean, it's one of the strongest episodes of season three, in my book.
Certainly.
And I suspect it's one of the more memorable episodes of the whole TOS oeuvre, would you say?
Yeah, when we had the discussion about when we said we were going to do a Spock episode, you and I talked and we said what we need. We're going to have a discussion about Spock because of Discovery and the new iteration of Spock. And also we thought, then we're going to pick a Spock episode. And there are so many Spock episodes that come to mind. But I think this one is perhaps not one that immediately springs to mind, but is a very, very important episode for Spock and Vulcans and the way that fans have treated him.
It's a pivotal episode. It's probably more a pivotal episode for Star Trek fandom and also for Star Trek fan fiction, I want to say, because it helps people to understand Spock's character and also the broader Vulcan world in a very effective and very straightforward way. It's a very beautiful piece of storytelling in that respect. I will begin with a modest criticism of this, is that there's a hell of a lot that's going on here. I'm sure the listeners are aware of this movie, of this episode. So I won't do a synopsis, but you've got Kirk and Spock and McCoy who have been transplanted into two different timelines and have to find their way back in order to end the series before the... You know, anyway, they're just... Because they had to end the series. So you've got Kirk's timeline, and then you've got Spock's McCoy's timeline going at the same time. And I think there's an awful lot that they try and pack in there. An awful lot happens in a very short space of time. And I'm not certain that it always... It feels a little bit jarring sometimes.
I think that this episode is actually a distillation of the best of what people saw as Star Trek. Because when I watched this the first time round, I got confused with this with City on the Edge of Forever. But because the thing is the jumping through portals and the sort of, you know, the time thing.
Mm.
And as a kid, that I jumbled these two episodes up. You know, even though they are actually a couple of years apart from when they actually made them.
Mm.
But also the core part of it is actually still the three characters, because you have no look in with any other characters except for like Scotty's voice from the Enterprise.
That's right. Yes, because it's the only episode of Star Trek original series which doesn't feature any bridge scenes.
Yeah,
it's just
no interior. It's the anti-bottle episode.
Yes, you know? It is indeed an anti-bottle.
There's no interior of the Enterprise.
And the point you make about it being fan fiction, it probably is, because the thing is that the person who came along and wrote this, I mean, she'd written another episode before, seemed to be a real big science fiction fan. Also, this episode has concepts which are from, you know, sort of like the golden age of science fiction, rather than sort of like the typical science fiction Flash Gordon stuff that you would have around as well. You know, so it tries to be sophisticated. Maybe there's just too much stuff that could have gone into this, and obviously it's a TV show, and it didn't live up to the what it could have been.
We did an episode on New Wave science fiction, didn't we?
Yes.
And obviously Star Trek's role and part of the New Wave of science fiction. It's available in our back catalogue. If you haven't listened to it, I would recommend it. It's one of our better episodes. And we didn't mention this episode.
No.
I'm wondering whether or not that was a mistake, Graham.
I think it was. I think it was an oversight, because this perhaps is one of the most New Wave style stories in the original series. It certainly offers a world of possibilities without perhaps explaining too much why those possibilities exist. I think if you want to get a bit nerdy about the episode, there's a lot of things that just don't make sense in it. But as long as you don't think about those and just go along for the ride, and it's a wonderful ride to go on. The fact that the time portal, that sound can travel through it is quite funny.
But I like that.
I like that. I love that.
I mean, you could say, well, that doesn't make any sense. It's time travel.
The fact that they go and beam down onto a planet 3.5 hours before a supernova.
Yeah.
You just sort of think, maybe you want to get out of there.
Yeah.
I just want to go and visit here. It's about to blow up.
Yeah. Everyone's left. So everyone's left, and we're going down there to find out where they went.
That's funny.
But they've left. So what happened? But it's literally blowing up. We should totally not be here.
Yeah.
You know, they're not here.
They've gone out.
They've gone. So why are we, you know?
Yeah.
And the funny thing is that there isn't actually any sense of urgency, actually, that the place is going to blow up.
But as I said, it's best not to think about these things. I mean, obviously, the clock is ticking, and they need to get out.
Sorry, this is where you just brought up Brexit.
this is where critics probably would look at it, because they'd say, look, you know, every story has to have its own internal rules.
Yeah.
And all our yesterday's rules are very, very loose. In fact, it doesn't really have any. But then the counter argument will say, well, look, if you put it in the context of 1960s New Wave science fiction, and you can say, well, actually, one of the ways that they pushed those boundaries was by having fewer rules about how to tell stories, about what to say. And I've got a lot of time for that particular argument. Mm-hmm. And for me, that's why this episode, I think, generally does work.
Sure. And then what it does is it comes up with a couple of concepts that actually you start thinking, well, is this something about time travel? Is it actually addresses time travel as something that could have a physical effect on you?
Mm.
Not just you just step into the past and you're the same person. It is like you could actually be the environment of the past, may kill you within a few hours, yes, if you're not fully prepared for it, if you're not changed in some way physically,
yes,
to cope with it.
And although it's not mentioned in the actual episode, conversely, it could be the same thing. You could come back into and bring all manner of stuff into an environment that where the ecosystem and where the immune system of the people around you have have no defense. You could end up spreading diseases, you know,
a modern disease in ancient times
because the people there have got no immunity to it.
Yeah.
And so the Atavacron, as it's called, works like that. Yes. Really interesting.
There's quite a lot of little really nice, you know, as you just mentioned about the sort of the environment and how, you know, that sort of changes. But little nuggets of ideas in this, you know, that what I found was really interesting was people on this planet are using this time travel as a way of escaping. But it's also they're a society, which is mentioned right at the beginning, that don't have any space flight. So the idea about escaping from somewhere using time travel rather than actually...
There is a profound metaphor there, isn't there?
You know,
I mean, escaping to the past.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, certainly. Literally escaping to the past. I mean, this is something that people do every day in their lives. Mm-hmm. People go through their lives. Yeah. And if you allow them 2 or 3 minutes or even 20 or 30 seconds of alone time to just think for themselves, there's a good chance that they're already recreating memories and stories from their own past. And this is that opportunity, you know, made real.
Yeah. Well, also, when they're actually going to escape, they're in this library. Remember the idea that they're in this library where they've got someone, the librarian, who's either an actual person or some sort of autonomous, or if he's also maybe different versions of himself at different times. That was quite interesting, whether that's, you know, because you see him all over the place. But the idea about people escaping from here, they're allowed to choose the event where they want to go in the past. Their favourite thing was he invites Kirk and the crew to actually choose where they would like to go, you know. And the idea that if you've got a society where you can choose yourself to go back into something that you're really interested in, and, you know, you fuck it up over there as well. You change the whole of the future.
They don't go to the rules of time travel, which is you go back in time to escape.
Yeah.
You know, to not change the... If you go back in time, you change it. So we learned nothing from City on the Edge of Forever, have we?
Maybe this is time travel of the infinite possibility.
Yeah.
Variety. Maybe.
Genuinely, who cares?
We don't need to know, but they're going into some past. And yeah, it's very, I think it's fascinating that it's set in a library because the writer was a librarian.
Mm-hmm. That's right, yes.
So maybe she is used to people who want to look at the past and want to be in the past. Yes. Look at ancient history.
Yeah. Books. Even if the books aren't about history, they are part of history because they are in some way connected to something from the past. Even if it's only a connection to when they were written or when they were published.
Yes.
But obviously, yes. Then you'll have a big history section which goes into the past, and it's a wonderful construct to have your time portal now part of a library where presumably, you know, in happier times, people would just go to then literally explore the past rather than not with books, but by going into the past and presumably coming back again.
But I suppose that's another thing. Maybe it's not actually a time portal. Maybe it is some kind of Matrix type thing that you're actually being sucked into
Wonderful idea that could be.
I thought that as well, because you remember... The other part that we haven't mentioned is that when Spock and McCoy go back in time, they go back to a sort of an ice age.
Mm.
Is Zara Beth, the character that they meet, she's actually sent back in time as a punishment.
Yes.
She's a prison for her, isn't it?
Therefore, that the Atavacron and the time portal were created not to escape the supernova, but it was created, you know, as their... Well, it was created for other uses, and that included... Presumably, at various stages of their history, for punishment.
But the idea—it probably isn't time, as you mentioned. It is probably a matrix.
This is headcanon, isn't it?
The story's pretty unambiguous. They do go back in time,
but it is something that you know, you can say, well, when I read a book, I'm going back in time, yes, in my head.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. But, no, but all of these things play. Yeah. They but work.
It doesn't,
yeah.
That means that you can actually get past the time paradoxes as well.
If you could do.
You could,
if you were, if that was important to you, but then
see,
that's the
see,
way
this
you could
is
do
what
it
does. You this see, Star you Trek start thinking about how this thing, when really the writer just yes, presented
you
a
story,
something,
yeah.
And, yes, and it's just people ask because we're.
Well,
because,
yes.
But then we're recording a podcast.
We are indeed, and we are literally here to talk about these things. But it is worth always reiterating from time to time that we say, you know, Starship was a serial anthology series. It was yeah, using the same characters, but effectively telling a brand new story. Mm. And there were not, the only a handful of stories actually had any kind of connection to previous stories, no, usually involving characters. So, I mean, we say, right, we're not going to sit and worry about how this works with City on the Edge of Forever and how our rules for that show, we're going to use different rules for this one because, you know, it's 1967 and no one's really thinking about this kind of stuff and no one's going to start thinking about this stuff for another, well, actually 5 minutes. But, I mean, you know.
But and, of course, the beauty of it is that, with all good science fiction, is that there's no new ideas. There's just ideas that people have been inspired by from other science fiction or other fiction,
yeah,
and they bring that there, and also they inspire other fiction and other ideas. So there's no, people could have seen this episode and taken lots from it and subconsciously or consciously taken it into new stories and sequels as well.
Well, what I found was really interesting that we did mention before we actually started this podcast, we did speak about, and Terry, you bring up the term a lot, slash fiction. And the thing is, someone, you know, actually, I think that this person, obviously.
I don't bring it out that much.
You do. Well, you do read it a lot, yes.
I don't read it. How do you know what I read?
Write a load of it.
You're right. But, you know, because, you know, the thing is, this was the second story that, who was it? It was
Jean Lissette Ariosti.
Her first story that she did, which was submitted on the fly, wasn't it?
On spec.
And she did a great story as well, which had some, again, really good science fiction concepts, new wave science fiction concepts, as we were just mentioning. And it's quite interesting that obviously Star Trek has a good amount of female writers in there. And this is an interesting episode because of it being an episode that has a romance, which is quite sort of direct as well, and
indeed,
you know, and goes into that slash fiction sort of side.
Fan fiction. Yeah, I mean,
yeah, it's
probably an early example of fan fiction, of the kind of fan fiction in which there's a degree of wish fulfillment on the part of the author involving themselves in romantic plot lines with beloved characters, and Spock is a very, very, was a very, very popular character, and the setup of a lone woman stranded, you know, then being, you know, involved in an intense, very, very sexual relationship with a Spock who's reverting to his sort of like animalistic, you know, forebears. I would think that there's probably quite a lot of wish fulfillment going on there, frankly, on a lot of people who will be watching that, of whatever your gender and sexuality, would be looking at that and saying, oh, yes. I mean, it's a very blatant episode in that respect, isn't it, Graham? Because Zarabeth it's very clear from Zarabeth, the moment Zarabeth sees Leonard Nimoy, sees Spock, sorry, that, you know, there's a strong physical connection. I mean, and within minutes, she is literally taking her clothes off in front of him,
yeah,
and revealing, yeah, the chamois leather that she's wearing.
Yes, yeah. I don't know whether this is a male fantasy or a female fantasy. Mm. Really.
I think it's both.
It can be both.
I think it's totally
both.
But
it is the classic, yeah, sort of desert island scenario, isn't,
yeah,
it, really? The
yeah,
two people stranded and, yeah, what else can we do?
Yes, what else is there to do? Yeah,
yeah, yeah. And Mariet Hartley, who is, yes.
Oh, she's stunning.
She is, yeah,
absolutely stunning. And I mean, you know, there is a bit of soft focus going on, which is a bit rubbish,
yeah, but unnecessary,
you know, completely unnecessary. Yeah, but I mean, it's also interesting because that plot line, because there's also the McCoy dynamic as well.
Yes.
And this is, you know, which if we in our own head canon, this is the final episode of Star Trek. It's an excellent final episode because it does carry that McCoy Spock dynamic all the way through to the conclusion of the series.
I think it works brilliantly with him. Sorry to interrupt, but I think that I was just going to say, I just want to mention about Kirk. He's left on himself. He can do what the hell he wants to in his own little episode where he's sword fighting.
Yeah.
You know, and the thing is with Kirk, with Spock and McCoy, they have a brilliant episode, which I'm sure that you can actually tell us more about.
Well, that. I think it's more the fact that McCoy is there to, as always, when you've got, well, the two characters are always there to be the internal dialogue that Kirk is having.
Yeah.
The rational and the irrational.
And on this occasion, Kirk's not there.
And Kirk's not there. But this is actually, now McCoy is actually the internal argument of Spock.
Yeah.
And now he becomes the sort of the rational voice.
Yes. Who's saying, what are you doing?
Yeah.
You're holding me by the neck, you know. I mean, I know we've had our moments together, but we're friends and comrades. We're just look at yourself.
Yeah.
And keeping Spock in, do you think actually that is really what McCoy's role has often been with Spock? Maybe we've not seen that. Maybe this is an opportunity to explore that side of things, that McCoy actually does, because their arguments often seem counterproductive. And they seem at odds. And yes, again, I think it's presented to help Kirk make a decision by seeing his two junior officers and his two friends battle against each other. But I think, but I think also you could say that McCoy has helped Spock be a better officer / person because of these arguments and because of it, he's been there to lay down some truth bombs when they've needed to be told. You know.
Yeah, I mean, McCoy is often treated as the useful idiot a lot of the time, though, as well,
true.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
Because he is the man who comes up with the ideas that you or I would come up with, or the normal person would come up. He's the normal person in the room, despite being the doctor who saves the day and everything like that. When it comes to having large scale ideas, he thinks small. And he's got to be the one who has to shut up usually when someone comes up with a new idea, or especially when Spock comes up and tells him, well, no, that's completely not possible at all.
Mm.
Go away with your Brexit ideas. That's what we get, don't we, with McCoy?
Yeah.
But we also get sort of the unbridled humanism of him, don't we?
And yes.
And of course, that's what Spock constantly keeps in check. So it does give you that the lines between the characters is the fact that there's a lot of McCoy in Spock. He just keeps him completely suppressed. He just that he doesn't want to let someone like that out.
Well, I think it's quite clever in this episode because obviously when Spock saves McCoy, brings him back to the cave, and then Spock can basically service the young lady there.
Yeah.
And everything's... And then, obviously, we're talking about the environment.
No, he has sex with her.
He doesn't service her. She's not a car, mate.
I saw those shimmy levers. I was just wondering... there was a can of turtle wax over in the corner as well.
Whatever floats your boat.
Easy. Now who's been reading fan fiction?
But I was just going to say that, so going back to the relationship...
No, please continue. I'm riveted.
Yeah.
So the turtle wax in.
It seems a lot of people rushing down the aisle for tomorrow.
It literally didn't occur to me. Anyway, carry on.
Anyway, I was saying that sort of like the obviously Spock saves McCoy. McCoy, now things are happening to Spock. Obviously, the environment is changing him, and we do see the time that he eats meat. He finds meat, and he starts to behave like a real man. Yeah, exactly.
I've eaten flesh.
Yes.
Yes, you have. And then you had some dinner.
Oh, where's that turtle wax? But obviously the changes are happening. But McCoy, once he gets himself back together again, he actually sees there is a problem. He actually notices it before Spock does.
Mm. But I'll tell you where I don't quite get is sorry to interrupt you is when he confronts them both.
Yeah.
And we don't see that journey that he takes. There's no reason why he should necessarily disbelieve what Spock is telling him, apart from the fairly obvious, well, you know, he's got a good thing here and he wants to keep it. But he goes on the attack to Sarabeth and accuses her of lying.
Yeah.
When there's no necessarily any way that he would know that is the case.
That's the compression story.
And that's the one that just doesn't work.
That didn't work.
I mean, if there had been time, they could have written in a just a 1-minute scene, maybe a between them, just...
I suppose there
where
is
where he might go, I think she's lying or something.
There, well, or else there is a thing of like, you know, she's the only person who said we can't go back. You know, how do you know that? Like,
yeah, she's that here could have been written differently, couldn't it? Yeah.
So I suppose there is that sort of thing there.
Yeah. These are small. It's a relatively small point. I would like to dwell on the Kirk side of thing. I know this is a Spock-heavy episode, and we were talking about it because we're doing it Spock. But I mean, I'll tell you what fascinates me about a lot of Star Trek episodes is of TOS episodes, and the one that springs to mind is this one, and also the Return of the Archons, is the portrayal of alien races basically like they're humans, it's Earth. So we go, we saw the Return of the Archons, Miri's another one that springs to mind, not Miri, whatever, but the Return of the Archons, where we're actually on an alien planet, we're talking with aliens, but they dress like in period costumes from Earth's history, they're human.
Yeah.
And basically these are the writers, the producers telling us that we're telling fables about ourselves rather than that.
Yeah.
And this
Circus is another example.
Exactly. Yeah. And I really appreciate that form of storytelling, and it's lost in modern Star Trek because we do things differently now. We have prosthetics, you know, and they can do that. But I think that I think it also, I'd like to posit this theory, which is very difficult for me to develop, so I apologise if I'm not articulating it very well. If you're struggling with visual canon over the years, then consider the possibility that what we're seeing is a perception filter over alien cultures to make it look identifiable to us as the audience.
Yeah.
And that actually the reality is different. And so if you work within those rules, then you can understand why the images and things change, why Klingons look different to how they were, why uniforms aren't quite the way they were, why characters change their appearances and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's the whole the book versus visual media thing, isn't it? I mean, with the book, you don't know that Atos or the other aliens there are humanoid, speaking English.
Speak English, look like human beings.
If we accept that everyone speaks English, then we have to accept that everyone looks like us. Yeah,
it could be something like a universal translator as well as translating voices, a perception filter, all of these things, but I mean that we the audience
are being told, well, these people are aliens, but actually we're the purpose is to tell stories about us, and so we're going to make them look like us, we're going to dress them like us, so that you the audience can relate to that.
And they've got a whole wardrobe department full of costumes already.
And they don't have enough makeup artists and enough time to change the appearance. Yeah. Obviously, as the franchise develops, they change that. But I do think something is lost there. That form of toy is somewhat lost. And that's one of the reasons why TOS is a treasure and needs to be preserved and watched and rewatched and valued, because of that format, if you like, has now gone.
Mm. You see, I, in our last episode, we were talking about Discovery and the franchise going ahead.
Mm.
One thing I wanted to actually say then, and this seems about the right sort of time to say it about, is that Star Trek, we love TOS, you know, and we watch it, and we can see that there's, you know, they're really well-crafted shows, and sort of like there's some nuggets of ideas and the whole thing, you know, and we'll keep going back to them and keep watching them. Is there any, would there be a problem actually by taking some of these old stories and doing a new series of Star Trek, the original series, but with new actors and stuff like this, and redoing some of the stories, but using the high production values that they have now?
I think what Terry was saying, I don't think the audience really accepts that nowadays. They wouldn't accept going back to 17th century England.
But you wouldn't do that. But then I think something would then be lost.
I'm not sure how I would like to see that.
When it goes back to the conversation that we did actually have in the last podcast about maybe a Pike series, Pike on the Enterprise series, but I would be worried that actually would be quite jarring, because if they were to do series 4 of TOS, for example, recast all the characters and just go back to series, it would be really different.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how it would, I don't know how that would work.
That wouldn't work.
No, I'm sure it would be fine. Things have developed. Storytelling has developed in a way that you just can't do that. And when you do, and when people do that, when people do go and do the fourth series of Star Trek, it looks dated, and it looks nice as a period piece or as a as a curiosity.
Yes.
But as a modern
Star Trek Continues, for example, but it's glorious. But yes,
as a modern TV show,
No, it doesn't really work. I completely agree. Just the storyline of Kirk's adventure, shall we say, to going back to witchcraft, and interesting choice that they've made about, you know, superstition and just getting a little bit in there just to give a little message about, you know, how you know, we used to be living in a world where, you know, superstition dominated our society, and now we live in a world where we're not supposed to do that. So I think even at this stage, they're still ramming home some of these humanist, rational messages that, you know, that we're civilized people capable of growth.
But also, he meets the person who came back. Who
goes back there?
But no, exactly. That asks more questions. Why would you want to do that? But then again, he's in some position of authority there.
Yeah.
So he's gone back as some, and it almost feels that's when it all starts feeling a bit sort of like Westworldy type.
Yeah,
yeah.
That you go back and you can live there, but actually this is quite deadly. This is actually they stay playing with the safeties off here.
Yeah. Also, definitely, the character he actually barely remembers the library as well.
Yeah.
As well as sort of like recognizing it, he has already become that character.
Yeah.
There
He's just a completely different life.
Completely immersed.
And then suddenly, because it is quite good how, I mean, the kind of direction is now, I think, a little bit dated. But when Kirk mentions library, and the zoom in on that actor's face and the look of alarm, and as if he's suddenly been awakened from a dream.
Yeah.
He's suddenly gone, oh, that. And he obviously, you know, probably shut it out from him. It's really interesting that they thought it through enough to be able to think, well, these people are going to be entirely immersed in their new world. Mm. And I do think it says something about how we do retreat to the past and sometimes live in the past. And I think that there's a good story that to be told there. Do you guys have anything else that you'd like to say about this episode?
Well, the machine that he uses, Mr. A to Z, he uses Gary Seven's computer.
He does indeed. Does he? Yes.
And another link with that episode is that Marriott Hartley was in a episode of Twilight Zone, a very famous episode of the Twilight Zone, The Long Morrow. Which is the one about the astronaut going away for 70 odd years, and she is the fiance in there, and the astronaut is Robert Lansing.
Seven. There you go.
Yeah.
We saw
that?
An adaptation of that, didn't we?
Is still in the West End at the moment.
I think so.
It's come back. Yeah, the Twilight. We're talking about the Twilight Zone theatrical production over here in London. If you ever get there, if they ever go take that to wherever you are, listeners, I urge you to watch it. We urge you to watch all Twilight Zone because it's all good stuff. You had something, don't you?
Well, there's a couple of things. Actually, the actress, what's her name? Marriott Hartley. She's still going. She's still acting.
Is she?
Yeah, she's 78.
Yeah.
And she's in, I can't remember what network it's on, but 911. She's a regular character at 78, still acting her way through this, which is really interesting. Also, she won an Emmy in a two-parter in the Incredible Hulk TV series.
Did she really? An Emmy?
Yes.
That series won an Emmy?
Yes, would you believe? She marries Bill Bixby in this.
Oh, does she?
And I think she probably dies, but I mean...
I think she's in the pilot, actually. She's in the car.
She's in the car.
I think she is. Yes.
I remember that pilot. Okay.
I think that's her.
Could be her. Yeah.
Fascinating.
Yeah. But she was in loads of. Obviously, you can imagine the series that she did. You know, she's worked all the way through. You know, her life. You know, great series like The Twilight Zone, as we mentioned. Mm. Logan's Run. She was in that for a while.
The TV series. She was. She also made another pilot with Roddenberry, Genesis 2.
That's,
oh my god! Yeah, I remember that.
And she had two belly buttons in that.
Did she?
Yeah, which we think is a throwback to when she had to cover up her belly button in this episode.
In this episode.
Oh, right. So she had to, have to cover up.
Yeah, she did. She had to go above the
belly button line, so it was a bit of a gag. Or it could be just some kind of weird Roddenberry sexual fetish.
Oh, totally, totally. Yeah. Yeah, totally. What can I get away with? What can I give it away? Two of.
All right then. Well, look, I mean, I think we're going to call it a day there, and go down the road and watch some football. And enjoy the rest of our day. Thank you very much for listening. I hope you enjoyed our musings on this episode. Something has struck me while we were talking. We were talking about the relationship between Kirk, Spock, McCoy and all of that. So I hereby arbitrarily have decided that our next episode will be about The Enemy Within.
Ooh. Nice.
All right. So until then, for myself, Terry, and from Derek Evergreen, it's goodbye.
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 And we are rolling again.
Rolling.
Keep them doggies moving real high. Don't try to understand them. Just rope them to a random.
Wishing my girl was by my side.
My heart's calculating.
My true love will be waiting. Be waiting at the end of my ride.
Welcome to Whom Pods Destroy, I'll start that again.